Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Those two things happened in tandem, and it's no accident. We basically allowed the private banking institutions that extended credit to you and me to buy a house, to buy a car. We allowed those institutions to link up with investment banks, with hedge funds, whose business was all about speculating on price movements in those secondary markets. It made all of that vulnerable. It allowed them to put guns to our head and to say, if we don't get bailed out, we pull the trigger and everybody dies.
Well, there you have it. A 30-second synopsis of why the 2008 bailouts were a product of an intentional regulatory shift that scuttled the Glass-Steagall protections and ultimately resulted in millions of homes and jobs being lost, vast sums of private equity and small businesses going bust, all because of Congress's obedience to its Wall Street patrons, who walked away with our Commonwealth while making a fortune in the process. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. Today, we're going to return to a conversation we started last time with Ellen and Dr. Bob Hockett, a noted monetary expert who has consulted the International Monetary Fund, the Fed, and who teaches at Cornell. Bob's discourse on our monetary system is a graduate-level discussion that you're likely to find illuminating and deeply thought-provoking as we all ask some basic questions about how our money and banking systems are failing to meet the needs of the common folk while egregiously benefiting the very few who speculate in the secondary market economy. As Bob pointed out in those opening remarks, the economic calamity that befell the entire country and even the world was no accident. Also today, we'll hear the second installment from Bob Bowe's book on global economic and spiritual transformation. Yes, economics has a role to play in transforming society and our own lives, and Bob will be talking about the illusions of political and categorical separateness that were collectively sold, which helps to keep us from working together to create sustainable lives, economies, and societies. But now, let's talk with Ellen, who's written a new article about the emerging digital technologies that are opening the door even wider for adoption of new banking-like services, and how they may change the role of banking for good. Both Ellen and Bob Hockett see this transformation as a necessary step forward that can help free us from the enslavement of debt bondage to the private issuers of credit, predominantly large private banks. One example of how these new technologies are affecting the hegemony of U.S. dollar on a global basis is that Germany is pursuing an exclusive European Union payment system as a way of saving the Iran deal that President Trump jettisoned earlier this year. Apparently, if the U.S. wants to go it alone, the world will make other arrangements. Now, let's talk with Ellen about what's well underway in China.
Let's talk about your article about the payment system that's on the horizon that would seem to be, you know, casting a kind of a weird colored dawn in the American payment system sky. I don't know if this is a good metaphor or not, but what's happening with China in their payment system could rock the world and is going to rock the world of banking and payment services here in the United States. Tell us what your article is about.
Well, our merchants in the U.S. pay quite high fees for credit cards, but in fact, your merchant is paying, on average, 2.75% for every sale. But nobody can compete with Visa and MasterCard because all the merchants are set up to take those credit cards and that you buy the little machine and you're in the system. But in China, they have circumvented that whole system with mobile payments. They never got Visa, MasterCard set up, fixed into their system. Instead, what they have is Alipay and WeChat Pay. So Alipay is the payment system for the equivalent of Amazon in China. And WeChat Pay is equivalent for their equivalent of Facebook, which is WeChat. And you just pay with your cell phone. So all these little street vendors, it's free. So all they have to do is stick a barcode on their little fruit cart or whatever they're selling. And the buyer comes along and aims his or her phone at the barcode, and the sale is made. It's transferred. And really what it started out as was sort of like an escrow system, because one problem they used to have in China with trades is nobody really trusted with online type trades was that people didn't trust each other to pay up. And so you needed a third party that would hold the funds till the actual trade was completed. And this has substituted for that. So anyway, that's the whole business in China. They're doing billions of dollars worth of trades, and they're basically cutting out the banks. The bank is there, like you draw on your bank account in order to load up your phone, and then that's it. So the bank doesn't get any of the perks that usually go along with these deals, and the bank has to worry about all the regulations and, you know, requirements for know your customer, that kind of stuff. So they get all the downsides, and WeChat Pay and Alipay get the upsides. And they're not really making a lot of profit off the payment system, unlike the credit card system in the U.S. What they're really making the profit off is their Amazon-like trades or their whatever, however they make money on their equivalent of Facebook. So they have these huge online marketplaces, rather like you could picture like Amazon, where you can buy all kinds of stuff. You can do your Uber or whatever. You've got all these different apps within Alibaba and WeChat.
And so the way they've transformed the landscape for payments in China now is that it is with this QR barcode that identifies all of the participants in the transaction marketplace, both the buyer and the merchant as well. So they match the two?
Sounds right.
So it obviates this hugely profitable component of the American financial system of how the banks just make tons and tons of money off of credit cards. It is a huge business. And apparently what we're seeing is the demise of this. And it would seem that this would be inevitable, that as technology replaces an expensive old system that looks like something on a piece of plastic, the Chinese and Starbucks and Amazon and eBay and all of the others are moving toward making the transition from cash and the bank networked system of transaction of payments to a virtual currency, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that was what interested me, was picture the possibilities here. What if Amazon, I mean, another thing in the news right now is that President Trump and Senator Elizabeth Warren are both talking about turning the big tech giants into public utilities for different reasons, but they both want to regulate it. She really wants to regulate them like she wanted to regulate the banks, or like we do regulate the banks, so that these technologies, the communications technologies, are another form of something that we all share that flows between us, the type of thing you expect to be in the public sector. So you've got transportation, roads, you've got water, you've got power, you've got money, which I think should be in the public sector. So picture an Amazon, which would be in the public sector, because that's one of the big giants that they're talking about regulating, to the point where it would be more like a nonprofit. There would be a cap on profits. It wouldn't be like it is right now. So, of course, it's not hugely profitable anyway. So it is said. I mean, Amazon already gives you pretty good deals, and that's why it's so popular. But anyway, so just picture a nationalized Amazon. What if we had an Amazon that was a public utility and you could trade on there? You would basically be creating your own money. It would be like a big community currency system. So it would be a big national mutual credit clearing system where you would create money by selling something into the system, and then you could buy with those credits, and that's how the system would work. So it would really be user-generated money, just like community currencies are today. But the problem with community currencies is that they're just too small. Like I used to be in one that was an electronic digital community currency, but the things I wanted weren't necessarily available. But if it was as big as an Amazon and it was national or even global, you could picture global, you could essentially eliminate money. You could be trading with credits. And it just acknowledge, which is what I've been saying for years, that that's all our money is, debits and credits. And let's acknowledge that instead of saying that we've got to go to a bank which gets the money somewhere. And then you make the bank do all this rigmarole where every night they borrow the money and then they give it back in the morning just to balance the books. Well, borrow it from whom? It's somebody else that is counting it on their books during the day. So you're double counting the money. So it's all fake money just to make the books balance. Well, let's just acknowledge that all we're doing is credits and debits. And if it were a public system, you could just be drawing your credits out of the cloud. I mean, you need some third party or some way to make the loans. You know, you need sort of the escrow agent. Like the credit card company, I think that's the good of the credit card company is that you can cancel the payment if you didn't get the goods, or you can argue about it. So anyway, I could just picture the possibilities for the future of a future monetary system basically without money.
This is, of course, what you were talking with our guest, Bob Hockett, Professor Hockett, in his new book and your new book, both talking about the future of money as being not money at all, at least not in the way that we look at it. We talk about banks a lot here because we're focused on a transition in that industry and in that profession from being a private-based industry to a public-based utility. As Professor Hockett says, that used to be the case that banks could not be interstate. They had to be local, and that the Federal Reserve 100 years ago helped to unify that system to make it more manageable from a couple of different respects, and also to be able to manage the industry of banking in a new way. And now, with this technology, you're suggesting that we may even take the next step, which is to be our own source for generating money, and we won't need the local banks at all. What will happen to the banks in that situation now, and what role would they play?
Well, it does. You do need some sort of middleman. I know that cryptocurrencies are supposedly eliminating the middleman, but nobody's ever gotten a cryptocurrency to work on a large scale, and you don't really need that. I mean, a national currency is national. We're talking about it is centralized. You don't need to get rid of the central regulator. I would say just make it public. Give it a mandate to serve the public interest, basically. You know, fully transparent, fully accountable, accountable to the people. So I could picture some sort of central government agency that are banks. In other words, just nationalize the banks and you fix the problem, it seems to me.
Of course, it would seem to me that there would be a need for the issuance of substantial lines of credit. Although
I see in
your article, you talked about even doing mortgages through this system. There's going to be a significant confrontation if this thing gets practically applied in the U.S. The big companies like eBay and Amazon and Facebook, and if they're able to issue money and manage exchanges, I think it's going to be cause a confrontation with the banking industry in a pretty big way.
Yeah, Amazon could start doing that themselves, and they are doing it to some extent.
Well, cash is certainly seems to be on its way out, which is a distressing sort of a notion in some ways. If only because when we get into a fully digitized, transactional technology era, digits are removable. They can be wiped out through certain electronic events. They can be wiped out through certain bureaucratic events. So we continue to find ourselves at working within the graces of the powers that let us use them, it's banking.
But I would imagine that science will come up with ways to make things more and more secure. I mean, they're certainly doing that already.
Well, Ellen, thanks for this new article, How China's Mobile Ecosystems Are Making Banks Obsolete, coming to an online screen near you soon. And we'll see what happens next.
Okay.
Thanks, Ellen.
Now, before we get into that extended conversation with Dr. Bob Hockett, here's the latest installment of our commentary Behind the Curtain with Bob Bowes.
In our new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, we identify and discuss concepts that are integral to humanity surviving its current crisis in a progressive and sustainable manner. The first six steps involve collective issues that must be understood by individuals, and the seventh step is one that each of us must take individually. As we discussed in step one, exposing the story of money and usury, humanistic values have been supplanted by the exigencies of capital, which is the value of labor that has been converted into a commodity by the charging interest for its use. To support this inversion, the central bankers, whose financial resources are bottomless, have purchased and developed a sophisticated matrix of scientific, educational, journalistic, political, economic, medical, and religious organizations and rationalizations, all serving to support this inversion of value. So in this installment, step two, rejecting the false divisions of ethnicities, religions, political parties, and nationalities, we are going to take a high-level view of how the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel and its corporate network leverages its power to maintain this illusory version of reality. One of the central methodologies that the cartel uses to promulgate their psyops and propaganda is conflating various independent ideas and groups into catchphrases by which they manipulate large segments of the population to keep them inside various mental silos that they also control economically, politically, militarily, etc. The most obvious example here in the U.S. is the so-called two-party system. Ostensibly, the blue and red party marketing brands are selling two different approaches to political and economic policy: equality for the blue party and inequality for the red party. But an examination of the actual effects of the legislation and policies coming out of the Beltway show that both brands support the same objectives. Beginning with Bill Clinton's crime bill, the incarceration of African Americans has continued to expand. Beginning with George W. Bush, surveillance and the shredding of the Constitution has continued to expand. And beginning with George W. Bush, global warfare for control of central banking and oil and gold reserves has continued to expand. The expansion of these criminal initiatives has occurred under both the blue and red branded presidential puppets. Much like Orwell's Oceania in 1984, today's political landscape consists of only one party under which the mirage of choice is actually a manufactured consensus. As Orwell noted in his seminal work, Politics in the English Language, if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. And certainly, the inability of large swaths of supposedly educated persons to see through the red and blue charade testifies to the effectiveness of this web of conceptual manipulation. Another obvious example of such conflation is the global debate over events in the Middle East. Generally, the conflicts are divided into Israel versus Palestine and the U.S. versus Iran, Hezbollah, and ISIS. But such characterizations gloss over a multitude of political, economic, religious, and ethnic conflicts. In reality, there are a number of longstanding wars, conflicts, and enmities in the Levant. One between three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, including fighting between different sects of each, various deep-seated ethnic hostilities, and the 500-year-old war between the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel and sovereign nations that control their own banks and currencies. Yet, in both the corporate mass and social media, as well as in the so-called progressive press, the Israel-Palestine issues are seen purely in political terms on an abbreviated timeline, which is, of course, why all the solutions have failed. Meanwhile, the actions of the cartel's mercenary forces, troops from the so-called governments of the U.S., U.K., France, Saudi Arabia, and Israel are characterized in the corporate mass and social media as fighting terrorists rather than having created the terrorist groups as an excuse to destroy sovereign nations, replace their banking systems, and steal their oil and gold reserves. All of this leads back to the central thesis of our book, that the root cause of global dysfunction is private control over money creation, and that, in addition to understanding how this dynamic dictates almost every political, economic, and military conflict on this planet, we must also each evolve spiritually to diffuse the religious hubris that is, in many cases, conflated with the root cause. Reporting from behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
And now we're pleased to bring you the remaining discussion between Ellen and Dr. Bob Hockett.
It's my great pleasure to be speaking with Bob Hockett, who is Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School and a former advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the International Monetary Fund, and was formerly Bernie Sanders' financial regulation spokesman, among other achievements. I have a couple of other questions. This is something I wrote in Web of Debt, which just seemed obvious at the time, and Bernard Leotard says so, and he's was a former central banker in Europe, that the problem is that private banks are creating money at interest, and they always want, like over 30 years, they want twice as much back as they put out there. So there's obviously going to be a shortage of money to pay off all the loans, and that's why we have this increasing debt bubble. But people have argued with that the debtors only have to pay off the loan 1 month at a time. And so if the bank hires you to scrub his floors, let's say you owe $1,000 a month, and say you borrowed $10,000 and you're going to owe $12,000 over a year, if they pay you back $1,000 every month, and you can use that same $1,000 over and over to pay the loan. So due to the velocity of money, there is enough money in the system to pay off the loans. But it seems to me the counter argument to that is that they don't hire us to scrub their floors. If they were public banks, they would. I mean, we would keep it all within one system. We would put the money back into the local community so it would be available to pay off the loans. But I just wonder what your response is to that.
Yeah, so I have several thoughts in that connection, and I think you're going to find them congenial. They're very much in the same sort of same line as yours. So let me start with the first reaction, which is very close to yours. You know, it's in a sense just my version of yours. And it's this. If you think about it, there are sort of two reasons for any lender to sort of charge interest on a debt, and there are basically two counterpart reasons for any public, any sovereign public, that sort of outsources the sort of credit allocation function to private partners like private banking institutions, right? So one of them is to give the credit allocators some incentive to allocate wisely, to allocate in ways that really are likely to sort of generate wealth, right, that really are likely to pan out and produce something. The idea is that, if a bank makes a loan that it knows is not going to be profitable in any sense, it won't make the loan. And under some circumstances, that can be a good idea, because we do, as a public, want even direct public lending to be productive in some sense. And you can sort of view the interest payment the bank gets as a kind of, we add an incentive to the bank to make wise decisions in that way. The problem, of course, with that is it also brings with it a perverse incentive, because once you introduce the profit motive rather than simply the break-even motive, the bank now has an incentive not to make even certain very productive investments, because lots of investments might be profitable without being productive. That's exactly what a loan to somebody who uses the proceeds to speculate on the secondary markets is, right? Hence, that suggests that maybe the break-even requirement would suffice. We wouldn't really need the profit requirement if we brought it in-house again, rather than, in effect, privatizing seniorage, which is what we do by privatizing the credit allocation function with the interest incentive. Now, the second and related point is the other reason that we have interest is, of course, it's a way of covering or providing against too much risk in the lending itself, right? The idea is, you know, if a loan looks like it's riskier, then you charge a higher interest rate. If it looks like it's less risky, you charge a lower interest rate. And then that component of the interest rate can be thought of as a kind of a risk premium. And that's a way of sort of, that kind of complements that sort of first function. It gives the bank an incentive, and now it gives the borrower an incentive as well, you know, to sort of be careful and to make sure before borrowing that the project itself is likely to pan out, is likely to do a good job, and is likely to enable then the borrower to sort of pay back the loan. And you're having to pay a higher interest rate is, among other things, at least possibly a signal that your project is being viewed as very risky, and hence maybe you should rethink it or rethink the way you're going to do it so that you can make it less risky and thereby more likely to, you know, sort of pan out and lower your interest rate. But here too, I mean, that function, that sort of risk reduction function or that safety maintenance function could easily be discharged by other means. For example, the requiring of certain forms of collateral, or by guaranteeing the lender some stake in what ultimately is produced, right? Something between a loan and an equity stake or the like. And that too could be done, right, in-house. It doesn't have to be done sort of out of house. And so I'm inclined to say that, you know, if we actually did bring it all in-house, then the very function that defenders of the system, like Ed Griffith, will sort of point to, or the functions that they'll point to, that allowing interest to you know, into the debt relation plays, can be played in better ways. You know, again, you can reduce the risk and by basically requiring a break-even sort of lending rather than, you know, basically saying, okay, yeah, you can charge as much interest as you want. And if you do it that way, you're not encouraging, you know, lending to sort of merely speculative activities rather than to potentially productive activities. And you can collateralize in various ways rather than charging interest as well, effectively allowing people then to monetize non-money wealth that they already have as well, right? But I want to be careful in saying the latter to emphasize that I'm not thereby advocating that either. I think there are certain things for which we ought to make quote-unquote credit available really cheaply and indeed maybe even free of charge altogether. We might even say, here's a good model, for example. As you know, some of the writing I've done lately has been on the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, or the RFC, which was by far the world's largest investment bank, and it was a public investment bank during the 1930s and the 1940s. And this was a New Deal institution. It made loans as small as $20 to African-American barbershops in Los Angeles and elsewhere in the West. It made loans as large as, you know, many, many millions of dollars for, you know, rural electrification projects and the like in the Deep South, all of this during the New Deal. And at the time, you know, this one institution's balance sheet dwarfed all Wall Street institutions' balance sheets combined. And this institution always turned the profit. It never failed to break even or better. But here's a key point. It did so well, and it balanced its portfolio so well, that it could afford losses on some loans, right? Some of those loans could go bad because others were going to be so productive that on balance it all turned out well. And then when it did make a profit, which it did, I believe, for every year of its operation, all of those profits just went back to the public fisc. They went to the federal government and thereby enabled the government to do even more in the way of direct public investments in infrastructure of various sorts, as it did, of course, during those years. That tells us something, right? That tells me that if we had, and by the way, the RFC had lots of sort of local branch offices all over the country, kind of a full network of these things. So we were engaging in just direct public credit allocation, but we were doing it in a way that basically was subject to two sort of desiderata. A, we wanted each project to be at least potentially, and indeed probably, beneficial to a wider public, not just to the individual or the firm that was making use of the money, but that would also produce, you know, sort of lots of positive externalities to the broader community. And then B, we said, okay, on balance, we want the full portfolio of the institution, of the RFC, to exceed the full class of liabilities, i.e. we wanted there to be at least some positive net worth in the thing overall. And that enabled the institution to take some risks on some projects that looked like they, if they did work, would be really salutary, because it knew that even if it lost on some of those, it would make up the difference on other ones. And my thought is that there are a lot of projects, like, for example, higher education. I'm totally down with debt-free higher education. I don't think that ultimately the profit motive should be driving lending to people for higher education that is likely to make them more productive and add lots of, you know, material wealth to our society as a whole in aggregate. And so there ought to be debt-free college. We ought to be doing that. And we should just go ahead and subsidize it. We should say, okay, let some of it take the form of loans, and let's say the loans have to be paid back. And maybe if the loans have to be secured in some cases, we might say, well, some portion of people's future income will go toward repayment of some of these loans if necessary, but never with a view to sort of earning a profit for the lender. And similarly for medical care, although, you know, as you and I know, if we did some form of single-payer system, we would probably actually save a ton of money compared to what we do now, and so we wouldn't even have to worry about, you know, break-even. But, I mean, I think to view higher education as something very close to a right, if not an outright right. And we shouldn't view it merely as a privilege, and certainly not as one that, you know, you have to indebt yourself seriously to avail yourself of. And I think the same of a number of other such things, like healthcare or health insurance, and a right to a job. You know, everybody should be able to be remuneratively employed. I think we ought to be looking much more seriously at ways to get more asset ownership into more hands. I think more people should be part owners of more firms rather than merely having to rely on labor incomes in order to earn their livelihoods. We should all be owners, in other words, and not just rental property instead of, you know, we don't have chattel slavery where we own labor, but we do still have rental slavery where we rent people. And I think ultimately human rents ought to become a much smaller portion of our economy as well, and people ought, there ought to be a lot more cooperative organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the great benefits of the view of finance that you and I have developed is it makes it clear how much easier it would be to finance a much more cooperative economy rather than a wage slave economy than we had realized up until now. We can bring that about through the financial means that you and I and a number of like-minded fellow travelers have sort of been working out over the last couple of decades.
So I'm arguing that the money is going into it, the speculative casino. They mm-hmm. might argue, even if it goes into the stock market, let's say, somebody mm-hmm. is going to sell those stocks ultimately, and the money will come back into this real economy. But it seems to me it doesn't. It seems to me that mm-hmm. it's trapped in the speculative economy, and it never comes mm-hmm. back, that we're just bidding up each other's asset prices. But I'm not really sure how to conceptualize that. It just seems to me obvious, but I can't put my finger on it or prove it. And also, mm-hmm. I wonder why it even matters if the stock market keeps going up. I mean, let them mm-hmm. speculate. Does it hurt anything? I can see why it matters if money goes into housing, because then that mm-hmm. means that people can't afford houses because all these mm-hmm. speculators are driving the prices mm-hmm. up. But mm-hmm. if stock goes up, so what? I mean, that mm-hmm. that money mm-hmm. doesn't really go to the companies. It just goes to the previous owners, and it mm-hmm. is a big casino, so let them gamble, mm-hmm. it seems to me. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the government could pay off the entire federal debt just mm-hmm. by moving it onto the balance sheet of mm-hmm. the Fed
right.
and the Fed returns the interest to the government, that it wouldn't hurt mm-hmm. anything, and basically what mm-hmm. you'd be doing is buying the bondholders out. Mm-hmm. But then the argument is, well, then the bondholders are going to spend that money. I doubt it. I mean, the reason they have them in bond is that they don't want to spend it, but they could mm-hmm. well move it into the stock market. But so what? So it drives the stock mm-hmm. market up. What's the difference mm-hmm. whether Amazon is at $2,000 a share or $4,000 a mm-hmm. share? So, do you have it?
Yeah. No, definitely. So, three answers to your two questions, right? Let's start with the first one. Ed's and others are saying that, well, you know, even when there's a crash, you know, there are people selling these things anyway. So, you know, for every loss, there's a gain. That's just double entry bookkeeping. Blah 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 blah. The problem with that is it's actually false, because it overlooks one very simple thing. The key to why it's wrong, I think, lies in another point that you and I have been at pains to make for some time, and that is that, unlike matter/energy, where, you know, matter/energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Money can be created and destroyed once you realize that money is debt, right? That basically money is a kind of circulating obligation, right? So when a bank extends a loan, it's adding to the money supply. And as that loan is paid off, of course, the loan is extinguished and the corresponding increment of money supply is correspondingly disappears, right? It goes away. And that's just another way of saying then that it's not like it's a constant amount all the time. There's a kind of potential fluctuation, and the counterpart to that micro point that you find in the financial markets is simply in the fact that tons of people go bloody bankrupt, right? But it wasn't the case that people simply sold the assets and other people bought them. Many of these sold assets were sold, in drum roll please, at a loss, right? That's why we called them fire sales, right? These were the asset market equivalents of bank runs, right? And as we all know, wealth is lost in a bank run. And likewise, wealth was lost in the fire sales, which were simply the capital market equivalents of bank runs. And of course, the counterpart of all of that in the housing sector was the gigantic quantum of so-called underwater loans, right? When 33% of the population was underwater on their mortgage loans, and when a huge percentage of those people ended up defaulting on their loans, there were huge losses on the balance sheets of lots of financial institutions, including banks. That meant that tons of these institutions had negative net worth by the end of all of this. That was the loss, right? That just is the loss of the wealth. The loss of the wealth is the negative net worth. And what makes it possible for there to be negative net worth, even in aggregate, even for the economy as a whole to lose wealth, what makes that possible is precisely the fact that most of the wealth that we have is in the form of promises. And anytime there's an overextension of promises, anytime there's too much promising, some of those promises are going to be broken. Some are going to be reneged on. And oftentimes, one set of promise reneggings like that opens into a cascade effect where lots more then end up being reneged upon. So you get a magnification of the initial losses. And what you end up with in the end is a sum total of lost wealth, which is just to say nobody believes even the promises that would have been fulfillable any longer. That's why we call it a crunch. And so you actually do have loss of wealth. And best place to find it is in the negative number balance sheets of various institutions in the wake of 2009, right, or 2008, 2009. So that's the first answer, I think, is that, right? A second part of an answer is that, let's say, even if Ed were correct, let's say that, to every loss corresponds a gain, and there's a complete balance between the losses and the gains, and so there actually is never negative net worth in aggregate. There's never, loss of aggregate value. Even if that were true, when all of the action is on the financial side, the financial sector of the larger economy, when it's basically all just, happening to, basically the gainers are rentiers, well, going back to your point, there's a reason that they were rentiers rather than consumer expenditure spenders or expenditure makers, right? There's a reason they were in bonds rather than in bread, right? And it's because of the old, I guess Keynes is the one who's most commonly identified in connection with this concept, even though Keynes didn't really invent it. There is this matter of, the change in your marginal propensity to consume as you rise up the income and wealth ladder, right? The more wealth you have, the smaller the percentage of your wealth you devote to consumer expenditure of the kind that actually prompts productive activity in the real side of the economy, right? The more of it goes just into the sort of speculative investing, just into sort of playing the markets. And so even if it were true that all of my loss in, say, the CDO market in 2009 had a counterpart in your Ellen's gain as the counterparty in the CDO market, if you yourself are heavily invested in CDOs, that itself tells us you've pretty much maxed out on your consumption. Your 10th yacht isn't going to yield you much more, any marginal utility relative to your 9th yacht. So all of your money is in the CDOs anyway. So it's not going to be of any help to the real economy anyway. And so then that opens up into the question, well, but is there possible harm into the real economy from this side of the economy, which connects then, which begins to get us into your second question or your other sort of big question. And that is, what is the connection between these two things? So what if the stock market goes up? Can we, is it okay to go ahead and allow that without it worrying about it causing any harm? I think sort of yes and no, right? In effect, this is the question about what precisely is the connection between the secondary markets and the primary markets, right? Now, the theoretical connection right from the start, and one reason that we've sort of been friendly to secondary markets for so long, and we've adopted so many public policies over at least the last century and a half or two centuries or more even, that are sort of secondary market friendly, is itself a product of our belief in the intermediated scarce private capital myth, right? So if you believe in that myth, then you believe capital and hence lendable or so-called loanable funds are inherently scarce. And so you think that means that interest rates are going to tend to be high. You know, people are going to charge money for the use of this scarce commodity known as lendable capital. One way of lowering interest rates in an economy and encouraging more lending and borrowing and hence more productive activity is to adopt measures that that foster or encourage the creation and growth of very lively secondary markets, because the more easily a would-be lender or other investor thinks that he or she can dispose of his or her investment or liquidate it by selling to somebody in the secondary market, the less risk they will see attaching to that loan or that investment, and hence the less interest they'll charge for it. And so there was a kind of a credit minimization incentive or argument for encouraging secondary markets. But there are two problems with that, and that this begins to get us into the answer to your question. The first, of course, is that the intermediate scarce capital myth is just false. It might have had truth to it in the 19th century when, as you said, we committed to maintaining a gold standard, although I would add the caveat that committing to the gold standard was itself a choice, too, that we didn't have to commit to that at all. But we did, insofar as we did commit to it, thought we had to, then, yeah, there could be a scarcity that was, essentially the exogenously given stock of shiny metal. But once we decoupled from that in the early 1930s, and then once we even globally sort of decoupled from it in the early 1970s, it's just no longer the case. And so one of the chief arguments then for encouraging lively secondary markets just evaporates with the intermediate scarce private capital myth itself. Second thing that's worth noting is that we went too far, right? We sort of proved too much in the sense that, to say that you need a deep secondary market in order to optimize interest rates or, minimize interest rates or other kinds of borrowing costs in the primary markets is one thing. To say that the secondary markets have to become 1,000 or 10,000 or 1 million times larger than the primary markets in order to do that is quite another thing. And we long, long, long ago, at least 75 or 80 years ago, I would say, had reached the point where secondary markets were much larger than necessary to optimize credit costs in the primary markets. This is effectively what Keynes was referring to in the famous chapter 12 of the famous general theory, when he sort of compared the foam to the water, right, and said that a little bit of foam on the surface of the water might be just sort of an inevitable byproduct of having water that moves, but when the foam comes vastly to exceed the water, when the foam becomes the sort of main event, then that's a sign that the job is being, as he put it memorably, ill done. And that's, it's an evocative image that I think the broader culture has kind of forgotten, but it's a very nice image that captures effectively where we are right now. These secondary markets are preposterously large in connection to the primary markets, way beyond the size that they would have been necessary even had the intermediated scarce private capital market been correct. In other words, they don't exist any longer to enable people to sort of dump primary market assets or loans when they need liquidity suddenly or whatever. They really have become objects of interest and speculation in their own right, which means that they're really not about facilitating productive investment anymore. Indeed, they operate as a competitor to private investment, because the private investor sees the chance of making, you know, a 20% profit in 1 year in a secondary market, and sees the chance of making like a 3% profit in 5 years in the primary market. What's he or she going to do? Of course, they're going to go to the secondary market. Now, so there's that. But now, finally, the final point to make here connects much more directly then to your questions, which is, well, might the secondary market even cause harm in the primary markets? Might the connection between them actually be perverse, not only unnecessary, but problematic? And my answer to that is that we could make the secondary markets unproblematic, even when they're huge, if we could in fact decouple them from the primary markets themselves. So what does that mean? Well, the way to get to what that means is by asking first, or answering first, what the connection is currently, right? In what way are they coupled? And the way they're coupled right now is essentially through these gigantic financial conglomerates that we have allowed on the books. You know, we've allowed by law for 19 years now, right? With the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, the passage of that act in 1999, we officially, legally sort of blessed something that had developed as a de facto matter outside of the law during the 5 to 10 years previous, over the course of the 1990s. And that's essentially, you know, the elimination of Glass-Steagall, the elimination of other forms of segregation within the financial markets that effectively allowed the big secondary market institutions to become institutionally affiliated with, and even to merge effectively with, the old primary market players. And it's no accident that all of this happened at the same time that another development that I referenced earlier happened. That is, namely, during the same decade, those wonderful Democrat administration 1990s, the Clinton years, when we not only allowed those forms of conglomeration to gather steam, but when we also eliminated the requirements for banks to be local and got rid of branching restrictions starting in 1995 on the books, and then 1997 when it all took effect. Those two things happened in tandem, and it's no accident. It's no accident at all. We basically allowed the institutions that used to be the primary market finance providers, the private banking institutions that extended credit to you and me to buy a house, to buy a car, to start a small business, or to sort of, you know, to undertake a new line of business in the small business that we already had. We allowed those institutions to link up with and connect with investment banks, i.e. securities firms, i.e. broker-dealers, with hedge funds, with other kinds of financial market player whose business was all about speculating on price movements in those secondary markets. And that had two effects. That meant first that the banks became themselves more interested in that kind of investing rather than in primary investing in people like you and me. And it meant that those banks, which we did still rely on for our payment system, because we all make our payments out of accounts held with those institutions, it made all of that vulnerable to the behavior of those banks in the secondary markets. So if a giant financial conglomerate that includes an institution that maintains your and my transaction accounts, out of which we make all of our payments, on the one hand, combines that with other institutions that are speculating, basically gambling on derivative prices or on other sorts of price movement in those various asset markets, on the other hand, what it does is it holds you and me and the entire bloody payment system and the entire bloody real economy hostage now to what happens in those secondary markets. So when a derivatives trader that's affiliated with a major bank that maintains transaction accounts for you and me that we use then to go and make payments out of when we buy our breakfast at a restaurant, when that derivatives trader goes bust or gets into trouble, suddenly there's a threat to the private bank that is associated or affiliated with it, or even kind of effectively merged with it, such as imperils the transaction accounts that you and I make money out of, and thus imperils the entire payments infrastructure, and thus imperils the entire bloody economy. And that's exactly why the bailouts happened, or at least that's exactly why it was possible for those who made the bailout decisions in 2008 to say, this doesn't affect just the speculators or the secondary market players or the hedge funds or what have you. It affects everybody. It affects everybody because they allowed it in the bloody first place to affect everybody. They allowed, in effect, the speculators to put guns to your and my heads and to the heads of everybody in the economy, even those who have nothing to do with secondary markets at all in any sort of direct sense. It allowed them to put guns to our head and to say, If we now if we go bust, if we don't get bailed out, we pull the trigger and everybody dies. And they allowed that to happen. So that means the answer, in my view, is we decouple again. And that's partly about reinstituting a counterpart to Glass-Steagall, but it's about much more than that. It's about completely decoupling the primary markets from the secondary markets. It's about, and that means then the secondary markets wouldn't even be secondary anymore. They would just be another kind of market that has no essential connection to the real economy. And it means allowing then for there to be a financial system that works for the real economy on the one hand, and that's the one that includes these Fed accounts that I referenced before that you're apparently writing a book on now too, that I can't wait to see when we trade drafts later today. It means doing that and thus making it the case that the stock market can become as inflated as you please without it's like harming anybody, and allowing other asset markets to do that too, because then it really does become a casino in the full sense of the word. I mean, people who refer to the secondary markets as casinos now, they're half right. They're right in the sense that those are the motives that actuate a lot of the actions there. And that's they follow the dynamics of sort of casino betting and so forth. And in that sense, they're all completely right, and it's a very helpful metaphor. But the one sense in which they're wrong is, imagine that the casino is the same business as the small business lender, right? And so then that means if the house loses, if the casino loses, or imagine for them, it's not even maybe that, it might be that somebody who plays on the casino, the gambler, right, the gambler who plays on the casino is also the small business lender. Well, now if that gambler loses on that casino, suddenly the small business lender is in trouble as well. And that means what? The small businesses are in trouble. And it means all the people whose jobs depend on the small business and all the people whose livelihoods or material well-being depends on the small business are in peril as well. So what's the answer to do? We say, okay, the small business lender is not allowed on the casino. And furthermore, the small business lender is not allowed to lend to anybody who does anything on the casino. The small business lender has nothing to do with the casino. The casino is just for rich people who have bought their 10th yacht, and they still are now, they're suffering a sense of ennui because they're not made happy anymore by all the money that they spent on consumer goods. And so they want to get a cheap thrill by bungee jumping or playing Russian roulette or gambling on casinos. And that's what those markets become. And as long as they're completely decoupled from the primary market, which they can be because we don't need them to supply capital in the primary markets, because the intermediate that scarce private capital market is false, because credit is generated, not intermediated. If that's all the case, as you and I have been at such pains for so long to make clear it is the case, we can decouple them and we can make them irrelevant in that sense, in exactly the way that you said. And then the public policy question becomes something a little bit different, and that is, wow, all that money that those people are, you know, just wasting by gambling on those markets, even though it's not harmful anymore because we've decoupled primary from secondary, could that money still be put to better use, maybe? And then the answer is yes. And one way to do that is, well, we could tax a little bit more of it away if we need to sort of tamp down inflation somewhere. Or we could tax some of it for other reasons if we needed to, if we thought that they're getting themselves into trouble with, you know, too much gambling or whatever. We could tax some of it away. Or if we just thought, well, you know, some of that gambling that they do, they're doing just because they can make more money doing that than they can in primary markets, which are currently not very promising. But we can make primary markets themselves more promising once we decouple them from those secondary markets. And we can make them more promising once we actually provide a stable macroeconomic backdrop, which an active government that is not acting under the illusion that it needs to raise money first can do. Lots of primary market activities will become more remunerative and hence become better investments. If you think about it this way, let's say you and I are a team and we're like an investment team. We're thinking about where to deploy some extra money that we've got. And we see two opportunities before us. On the one hand, we look at a small business and it might actually produce something that's really good and that turns out to be profitable and that ends up bettering society and the material well-being of everybody and ends up being, you know, profitable for the business in consequence. It might do that. But we also know that whether it does that or not is sort of dependent on what the national employment rate is, whether there's a nationwide recession underway, what other macro conditions are like out there, you know, what the interest rates are and so forth. All of it depends on that, and that small business can't control any of that. And furthermore, that government has been captured by a bunch of idiots who think that the role of government is to kill itself. Well, then the prospects of this small business are not going to look very good. And so you and I are going to think, well, we might not actually make much money by investing in this business, not because it's not a really great idea, but because the macro environment is very hostile to the small business. The unemployment rate is probably going to be high. There's probably going to be another crash and another recession. This business will probably therefore go out of business. It will probably lose our investment. So even though in healthier macro conditions, this micro business would be great, under the unhealthy macro conditions we have now, this micro business is not going to do well. So maybe we shouldn't do this. And now we look in the alternative. We look at the secondary market. And we say, well, in this particular, there's an investment right now. It's called a subprime mortgage-backed security. And 10 years from now, this thing's going to be worthless. But in the next 5 years, it'll probably gain a lot of value. So if we invest in this thing, if you and I, if Ellen and I spend our money right now to buy this thing, if we, you know, buy it and hold it for 5 years and sell it 5 years from now, we'll probably triple or quadruple our investment. And then we get out in time, and then after the crash happens, it doesn't matter because we've already pocketed our winnings. You and I might very well do that right now with some cryptocurrency. You know, we might look at Bitcoin or some other. We might, what's the latest newcomer? You know, maybe it's some form of Ethereum or something. We might decide that because it looks more profitable to us now. Now imagine a different scenario. Imagine a government that actually provides a stable macro environment, and it does that partly because it realizes that austerianism is bullcrap. It realizes that it doesn't have to raise money before it can spend it. It realizes that it's its function, it's its responsibility to take care of this massive collective action problems that just are the problems that afflict a macro economy, and that by definition no individual actor, no small business or individual citizen can solve because they're collective action problems. A government that sees that that's its role and that's its responsibility, and it does that, it provides that stable macro environment. Now you, Ellen and I think, hey, this interesting small business idea, it looks really good, and the macro environment is friendly, not hostile. This business will probably do well and turn a profit and become profitable. This looks like a more attractive investment to you and me now. And we think, you know, that sort of mortgage, subprime mortgage-backed security, fewer people are investing in that now because they themselves also see profit opportunities in these small businesses. They're investing in this too. There's therefore going to be less speculatively driven price rising in the secondary markets in these mortgage-backed securities. And at the same time, there's going to be more profitability in these small businesses in the real economy. So you and I have less incentive now to join the parade in the mortgage-backed securities market, and more reason that the counterpart to invest in the real economy. And similarly situated people, literally scores of millions of people just like you and me, are thinking the same thing and putting their money there instead. That makes all the bloody difference in the world, right? That makes things just hugely better, hugely different. But I think a prerequisite to our sort of seeing it is seeing two things. First, this collective action point that I made a moment ago, that so many of the macro problems that we face are collective action problems, which is exactly why private markets can't deal with them, because private markets, by definition, are markets that are essentially aggregate the behavior, the decisions of lots of micro units, no one of which can control the macro environment. And so that's the first point people have to realize. And the second is they have to realize, you are my point, that the governments are not constrained. If they're acting in the name of the sovereign public, they are not subject to some intermediate scarce private capital constraint. All the credit out there is already generated by them anyway, whether they realize it fully cognizantly or not, and they're not constrained in the way that they thought they are. They can provide that necessary macro environment, and they can even do a lot of the allocating and investing themselves in the way that we did through the RFC back in the 30s and the 40s, and in the way that we even do to this day in many ways, by subsidizing mortgage lending and by subsidizing agricultural lending and subsidizing some degree of small business lending and various other kinds of lending.
Okay.
A lot there, right?
Great to have your solid academic input and grounding on all this. So it's been great talking to you.
Okay, thanks, Ellen. You too, and bye for now.
I've been speaking with Bob Hockett, who is Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.